Blog Talk Radio.
It's not just Washington that is broken. It's America who is asleep at the wheel. Why do they tell us that the Constitution is outdated? Can you outdate liberty? This is Brett Rappaport, and you are listening to the Final Say Radio Show. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to the Final Say Radio Show. It's Brett and John Rappaport. Andrew on the boards, our lovable producer. I don't know what to say about today. It started off chiseling ice off my car, and it's been about the same all day long. In fact, what's interesting about that is the fact that I feel like I've been chiseling ice off of all of the news articles and stories that we've been reading, preparing for today, because there's a lot of ice building up on the relationships between, whatever you want to call them, but we'll just refer to them as the leaders of various countries throughout the world. But, you talk about some cold relationships, John. So we'll come back to that. And also later in the program, we're going to have a frequent guest who joins us, Dan Kish, who's a senior vice president with the Institute for Energy Research. He's going to be joining us later on to discuss, I know it's an energy discussion, but it also has a lot to do with policy, foreign policy, and the impact of some of the things going on in the energy world and how they relate to some of the geopolitical things that are going on right now. So we'll get to that a little bit later. And, of course, just to give you a little update on the usual ongoings throughout the week, James S. Robbins will be joining us tomorrow, Tuesday, as he does every week. Tiffany Gebe, who is now with the London Center for Public Policy, for Policy Studies, will be joining us as well. And we've got other people lined up, but that's just what we've got going on in the near future of the Final Say Radio Show. But without further ado, I have a story here that we don't get into this all that often, but I think it's important for several reasons. And as you relate it to some of the other things that are being tried by the lefties who are running the Democratic Party these days, you'll understand that they continue to try to recycle ideas that have failed in the past. And this is a story I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal. And youth justice defies easy fix. Governor Cuomo, the New York state governor, has a recent proposal to treat the New York State 16 and 17-year-old defendants as juveniles rather than adults. And this would end a practice that some have long decried as counterproductive and inhumane. Advocates of this overhaul say putting teenagers in adult jail exposes them to violence while depriving them of education and treatment. They point to studies showing the results. The result is higher suicide rates and recidivism. Anyway, so here's the issue here, and you're talking about 20,000 new cases a year throughout the juvenile system in New York. So we'll get into some of the finer points here, but when I look at, in particular, New York State, which, you know, with de Blasio and Cuomo, and they're obviously heading in the wrong direction. There's many issues with regards to the relationships with the police force, as would be understandable having read or witnessed or or heard some of the comments that they've made regarding the police force, and none of it has been kind. I'm saying it nicely or lightly. You know, the issue here is, I think we could all agree, is it the age that should be considered, or is it the severity of the crime and the individual circumstance. Because I would agree with you that if you took a 16-year-old who was caught, you know, selling a handful of pot to some friends and threw him into a jail that they, you know, a regular prison, that might not be a smart idea. And I may agree with what they're saying here, you know, Cuomo and his team. However, we are well aware that very young kids, even as young as 9, 10, and 11, it has been documented that kids as young as those ages have murdered, have committed some of the most horrific crimes just to gain access to a gang membership or things of that nature. Some of them are involved in their own drug trade or whatnot. And the fact is, a young kid who's willing to pick up a gun and shoot up a place, killing numerous people, or a young kid that rapes repeatedly or commits other acts similar to that, they're just certain crimes that it's not the age. And quite frankly, if a 15-year-old kid is already, you know, a sociopath and murdering, I don't even care to try to rehabilitate him. I think we just need to get them off the grid, because we have millions upon tens of millions of people in this country who are normal, law-abiding citizens who could certainly use a lot more assistance than if that was the path we were to go down, than some of these just waste of human lives. And I hate this, you know, hey, I'm just saying it the way it is. You know, if we want to really deal with, you know, what makes people into criminals, then the billions upon billions or really trillions of dollars that we've spent for decades in these inner cities or places where a lot of this crime takes place, if we actually started doing things that would make the course corrections in those communities and neighborhoods and give them options, then perhaps that would be more impactful than just saying that, he's a 16-year-old who murdered five people. We're going to just throw him in a juvenile jail because we could fix him. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you're talking about the same politicians who push for this stuff, who haven't fixed a single problem since, you know, in some cases, some of these guys have served 50, 60 years in, you know, in public office. They've never fixed a damn thing. So what makes you think anything is going to change? So here's the other thing that's interesting. When you look at the availability of facilities, there aren't enough facilities available to even house what they're talking about doing. And here's another thing. Juvenile detention facilities, short and long-term, cost the state $400 to $600 a day per inmate, compared to roughly $75 a day for adult jails and $55 for state prisons. Well, no wonder, you know, maybe that's the reason why they want to just throw them in with the adults. But so let me get this straight. Some kid who doesn't want to go to school, who wants to gangbang or do whatever he's doing, get involved, and everybody, well, hopefully around him, is telling him not to do. And then we're supposed to take $400 or $600 a day and spend it on them to house them and try to rehabilitate them? I don't know about you folks, but, you know, they say the per capita income in the United States, you know, for family income is roughly 50, I think it's maybe up to 52,000 a year right now. Well, you know, $600 a day? Who the hell is going to pay for that? That's a lot of money. That is an extraordinary amount of money. And I'm just doing some rough calculations here. And you're talking about $150,000 to $220,000 a year. Well, again, how many people from these communities even would have to pay taxes to even cover the bill for one person being incarcerated? Well, if we've proven that the majority of people in some of these neighborhoods aren't even paying tax, then really it takes almost a whole entire community to cover the bill for even one of them. So again, you have problems in communities that the bill is going to be paid for by other communities. I think it's time to fix the problems in these communities and make them bear the cost. Let them bear the cost, and I'm sure you'll see some different results. John?
Right, I saw a very interesting special last night with John Stossel. And, you know, John Stossel, like all these guys, you know, you look for your angle, you look for the thing that matches your own agenda. But as a general rule, I think John Stossel does a very good job of explaining in a way that people can understand the complexities of why, in most cases, the government is not the answer, and why a more libertarian, localized, citizen-driven problem-solving effort is far more effective than, you know, a centralized planning government, sort of Obama, Hillary, Marxist, Leninist type mentality. And it doesn't matter what you apply it to. This is what's interesting. There are certain things, without a doubt, even Stossel, who's a pretty hardcore libertarian, would admit when it comes to things like central planning for a military or for highway infrastructure that is required. But that there are many other things that may be large infrastructure, not even local infrastructure. You know, having pointed out private roads and things that have been instituted. But I want to go back to there was a case that he did an example of where, I don't know if you saw this, but they actually had a skating rink. And they're essentially comparing the almost inexplicable human nature of looking at an ice skating rink, of how people of different sizes, athletic abilities, ages, physical capabilities in terms of experience, in terms of just ability, in intelligence, everything across the board. And yet the entirety of this mass, all over the place, no matter how many hundreds of people you throw on the ice, somehow figure out a way to move in a unplanned but very natural rhythm, much like schools of fish or flocks of birds and things will have a tendency to manage to self-organize, essentially, and how that can be applied to solving most of society's problems. And there were some very good examples applied to crisis response to storms from Katrina to Sandy to tornadoes that went through Oklahoma, and how effective the local response usually is, whether it's just local citizens, local communities, because that's how man survives. And so you made the point about the localization of the solution versus sort of the nationalization of the problem. What was very fascinating to me here was looking at the comparison of problem solvers, not problem planners, problem solvers like local ministers or pastors or other, you know, nonprofit charity folks, local companies, and in some cases just retired citizens with a pickup truck who decided to come from three states away to see what they could do to help with their tool belt. And people managed to solve very difficult problems, some that were that almost seemed insurmountable, like, well, my God, at this range, only a centralized, you know, heavy government footprint could solve a problem like this. And then, Brett, you looked at most of what the government was doing, and it was the typical cluster: too long, too much money spent, too many pockets being lined, too many decisions that really were too far removed from the individuals and seemed more designed to, you know, for political payback. And the net result is the local people doing what people did 1,000 or 10,000 years ago, whether it was in China or Bolivia or the Amazon rainforest or in Paris. It didn't matter. People always sort of rose to the occasion. And I think we have to look at those kind of things with crime. So there's two issues you have here. One is, it's very difficult when you have this sort of centralized planning to try to solve a problem that really requires a more local solution. These kind of this central feel good things where you have a tax cheat like Sharpton at the White House with a race baiting president, and trying to solve problems like Ferguson. These things have been solved throughout history by dealing with local police, local mayors and councilmen, local clergy, with the application of things like, you know, parental discipline, social shame, and other things. And the result of all this heavy centralized government planning has not really helped. The only reason crime rates have gone down to a large extent is because of a lot of the same type of heavy policing, both the broken window policy policing that people like Giuliani, really Giuliani led that effort, as well as sort of a nationwide effort to go after gangs and to start really trying to tackle that problem that was spreading around the country. So one of the reasons why crime is down is because some of these people are put in jail. But there's a nobody's responsible psychosis here, which is also a problem. And if age, look, you can't compare a 6-year-old to a 16-year-old. But there are other metrics beyond age that matter. As you know, there are adults who can't think with the capacity of a 9-year-old for various health or other reasons. Then you have some young people who are surprisingly capable as thinkers. Then you have emotional maturity levels. But Brad, let me just point out the fact that there is at some reasonable point, there is an argument to be made that a human being is broken beyond repair. And that might be a shame for that person, but I think as much as I'm a huge fan of the rule of law and protection for the individual, I think that's the basis of this country, I think when it comes to crime, violent crime specifically, as bad as losing money is, there's nothing, you can't compare being wiped out financially to being raped or stabbed. But let me give you an example of a crime that just happened. You had a 16-year-old from Pennsylvania being accused of murder by the cops because he shot another, this is in the Pittsburgh area, he shot another teen in the face and then posed with the victim's body for a selfie. Fortunately, had the self-discipline and maturity to show it to his mom, who immediately turned it over to the police. Now, you look at somebody like this, and the psychologists would come in, and they can blame society, and they can blame all kinds of things. But at the end of the day, society may want to consider him a child because he's 16, but if you could shoot somebody like that in cold blood in the face and then take a picture with it and pass it around like a trophy, as far as I'm concerned, I don't even care about rehabilitating that person. And I don't care whether you turn that person into soil and green, like the Ultra Alton movie. I don't care whether you feed that person to the sharks. I really could care less. Quite frankly, I think the only way to prevent a lot of these, I mean, true broken minds are capable of doing horrible things. But I also think there's a level of just narcissistic, I don't care, it's always somebody else's fault, anger attitude that can only be cured in two ways. One of which is prevention. But when that fails, I think you take something like that, you put them in a pink jumpsuit, and you say, you will start, before we even ever could have a parole board meeting or anything, we will start with 10 years of hard labor, and that's it. And then you show that. Have hard labor TV. Show people what it is. You think it's fun. You think raping a 14-year-old girl. Look at this other degenerate who was traveling with this 13-year-old girl or whatever that he was raping. Yeah, there's no such thing as consensual rape between like an 18 and a 13-year-old or consensual sex. Let's call it what it is. It's rape. And, you know, and you look at a guy like that, again, do you want to hear about the cure? I don't. I want to protect the healthy children. I want to protect society from people like that. And I'm sorry. I agree with you fully. I think this kind of the sort of criminality is, it's an evil that we can't put up with in a healthy society.
Yeah, that's correct. And I equate this stance on this particular issue, just like I do all the other liberal issues. It seems the Democratic Party, again, is taking up the mantra of we need more taxes, we need more taxes, we need more taxes, because we know everything we do is pretty much a failure. So we're going to just double down on promising that we're going to give a lot of stuff away to people and hope for the best, and because nothing else is working. Well, you know, here's my advice to most of these liberals. The reason that your ideology isn't working is because it's never going to work. It's a failed ideology. And I just give the example, go over to Europe, who is long ahead of you in trying this type of experimentation on everything we're discussing here on the program always. And, you know, even a country of France, Portugal, Spain, Greece, Italy, just to mention a few off the top of my head, who are like absolute failed economies and have major significant issues, and other states are soon to follow because, you know, Greece is about to implode or you know, not that far off again, and it's just going to cycle to the rest of the countries, and they're all going to go to the same usual players for the bailout. And I don't know if the bailout's going to be there. Anyway, we're going to move on from that because there's another, you know, there's a series of things that really must be discussed. You know, don't let me just, I guess I would be wrong to fulfill an entire show without saying this. Again, folks, we have a president who it really, I mean, it's still hard to believe he is a president, let alone the manager of a McDonald's. But he is, and it's what we have to deal with until he leaves office or is removed, which unfortunately there's not one brave person in Congress willing to do what should have been done long ago. But I look at the Ukraine crisis, I look at some of the other crises. It's amazing to me that Jordan, basically a country, you know, this tiny country, could make more brazen statements of strength with regards to the Islamic State than this president could ever possibly utter and conjure up, regardless of who was trying to force him to do so. It's just never going to happen. So, you know, the reality is, and I would say this one statement with regards to the Middle East and the Islamic State. I have no problem turning, you know, pieces of the Middle East into parking lots. You know, because quite frankly, there are large pockets of these terrorist type people and places that are just so despicable and really deserve it. But the fact remains that until some of the states and governments that actually occupy the region decide that they're going to stand up for humanity and take a course of action to stabilize the issues in their own lands, then we could bomb till you run out of bombs and equipment and materiel to make the bombs. And short of killing every last one of them, you're never going to change the situation until, as I said, these states decide for themselves that they're going to root out the corruption, the fanaticism, the funding of terrorism, the use of terrorism to try to promote whatever it is that they feel is their policy. And, you know, again, it's another failure. And short of some valuable real estate in places like Dubai and just oil money, if you took those two things away, there would be people wouldn't even go to the Middle East for most places. There wouldn't be any reason to. So, again, it's about time that just like when and I'm going to take a little sidestep here because I need to. I'm always a little all over the map, so you're used to that. But it's important to understand a couple things here. In the conversations that we have, and I have quite often conversations with people who come from some of these countries, and in this particular case, I'm going to refer to people who come from Ukraine and Russia and some of the other states, but particularly those two places. And I've had discussions with people who are in the western part and the eastern part, people who are from Moscow, people who are from out in the Urals and even Siberia. So we've got it all pretty well covered. And there's a common theme here. When you look at Ukraine, most people are upset with what's going on. Just that it's happening, people are dying. Because in many cases, it's their friends, family, or people that they know who are caught in the middle or part of it, you know, but one or the other. And I just saw an article from Stratfor, which is another one of these, you know, think tank type places. And they, too, just put out an article. I didn't have a chance to read the whole thing yet, but basically saying that it doesn't matter if we give you know, all the weapons to the Ukrainians, they simply don't have enough people who would volunteer to make up the army that they would need to face off against Russia. And that's an absolute fact. And I'm going to tell you that I've spoken to people who are anti-Russian, who are really, pro-Ukrainian. I mean, they believe in Ukraine, what I mean, and they don't want to be a part of Russia. It's not that they, they don't mind the Russian speaking and they're friends with Russians, but they don't want to be part of Russia. Yet they don't want to run off and fight and die for something that they don't even understand why the heck they're in the middle of in the first place. And there are a lot of people who are running away from or leaving that part because so they don't have to be forced to go fight for something they don't really believe in. I come to the question I've been asking for some time, and it is why? Like, I don't understand why you're pushing so hard for this particular thing. It's not going to make a difference. At the end of the day, we are not going to put 100,000 boots on the ground and fight it out in Ukraine. We're not going to do that. I mean, if you think Obama's going to do that, then, you're not paying attention. Now, we may end up in a conflict, but it's not going to be like that. So, again, when you come to what I had said earlier just a few minutes ago about, being a responsible nation, the problem I have here is that, amongst others, that I'll re-mention, but it's irresponsible for Russia to have taken parts of Ukraine over the way that they did, regardless of whether they think they're right or maybe they are right, that it's in their best national interest. Quite frankly, I always looked at, like, even Cuba, that, we should be controlling Cuba or understand that there's no threat in Cuba against our homeland. And, that's a whole nother show, because right now I don't think we're paying attention or properly handling most, if any, threat. So, again, I come back to this. Russia's wrong for have taken territory from the Ukraine. They're wrong for, dumping mass weapons into Ukraine and really furthering the fighting. But they're doing it on purpose, and we know why they're doing it. I've heard conflicting reports that we've actually put weapons in Ukraine, even though we haven't admitted to doing so. We have admitted that we're training Ukrainian troops. Again, I just don't understand why we're doing this at this time. I think there's different course of actions. I see Angela Merkel, the Japanese prime minister, really trying to work hard, and she's caught kind of in the middle between, on one hand, Barack Obama saying one thing, and then, of course, how she has to handle Moscow. So she's caught in the middle. I don't think Germany doesn't want to fight here. Germany wants this resolved. Germany wants to go back to building or maintaining some relative strength that they have within their economy. There's a lot of money to be made here, and it always comes down to money in this particular case. And by the way, I came across an article before, someone in Moscow making a statement like to Angela Merkel, don't make demands and Vladimir Putin. In other words, this is interesting. Don't give him ultimatums. And, to me, I think that's kind of a nonsensical statement. It's like, really? Because what are you going to do? Oh, because we tell you have 2 weeks to do something in Ukraine, to pull out troops or stop sending weapons in or whatnot, or we're going to put new sanctions on? What, is Russia going to declare war on Germany tomorrow? I mean, it's like, it's getting out of hand is what I'm saying. There are a lot of statements here that are completely, it's reached the point of absurdity. And here's the problem. And I was just laughing. The problem is you have a president who even members of his own party have absolutely no confidence in. There's no confidence. So without confidence, how would we ever want to go to war? I'm serious. I think we're better off losing ground and then coming back in 2 years and dealing with it than getting involved in something that, again, the McDonald's manager, if he's even that capable, would be in charge of. John. Do we really want to go there?
I think you make a good
this
point.
Guy,
not,
this guy couldn't hand you a hot dog and get the ketchup on it.
You don't engage in a war you can't win. Well, first off, let's just be clear. You're not going to need it. By the time he's done with the $15 and then $20 an hour pay, you're not going to have anybody left working these things. They're all going to be automated machines. Anyway, you'll have drive-up machines in the back. A truck will come at 2 in the morning and fill up the ingredients. It'll be like a giant vending machine. I didn't even discuss with you when I came back from the Consumer Electronics Show. You know, it's amazing the quality and the advancements being made in robotics as well as vending machines, and the combination of the two is a job killer. So, you know, just keep raising the wage and nobody will hire, people won't hire. What do we want, a bunch of snot-nosed kids who don't show up on time anyway, if we can have a machine that does it better, more consistent, more efficient, and by the way, never calls in sick because, you know, his girlfriend was sad and lonely and he was going to make her comfort her. But anyway, back to the serious subject at hand, Brett. I think this whole thing is extremely important because if you look at the situation that you have right now, not only very volatile, but it's volatile in either direction. So forget the fact that we have a leader who's completely void of strategy, but inside of this vacuum, we could have a guaranteed backfire due to excessive appeasement, but we can also have a guaranteed backfire, and maybe backfire is the wrong word, let's just call it potential calamity due to unintended consequences. We just don't know. Any aggression can actually snowball pretty quickly. We've seen this, and we've already discussed in the final say before, this is a repetitive pattern in history. I think the thing that's very important, and it's difficult right now because, again, we have this leadership vacuum, is you have to find additional ways to do this. You don't always have to meet force with force when you're dealing with somebody that you can control pain over. And, you know, we have a guest coming on shortly, and we're going to be talking about energy, but just to give you a comparison, I'm going to save that for when our guest is on, but suffice it to say, when you look at Russia has managed to essentially hold Europe hostage using energy as a weapon, and that's become a huge problem because it greatly weakens countries like Germany, who other than manufacturing prowess and economic capacity, has essentially become fairly weak. They're not a particularly strong country militarily, and by whatever their technical capabilities, I mean, clearly they're still one of the world's greatest shipbuilders, both surface ships and submarines. They're perfectly capable of building airplanes and other heavy equipment and weaponry. The problem is Germany doesn't have the assets nor the stomach to even fight something like this. So if your frontline country isn't willing to take on the burden, you can't expect that the people inside of Ukraine are really going to do that. So I think it's a mistake. However, there's endless other things that you can do. Besides tightening the economic screws, you look to start undermining Russia everywhere you can. And as an example, one of the ways you could have done that would have been to completely isolate, surround, drown, and weaken Iran, which you would, of course, want to do for various nuclear armed terrorism reasons, but even as a counter to Russia. So all of a sudden, had we played our cards differently, Assad could have fallen, and the Russian, the idea of that Russian base in Syria could have very quickly gone away. But that's not the case. You have the opposite case, where you have a lot of feckless Europeans who are worried about the fact that Russia has the puppet strings to keeping their lights on. So when you subject yourself essentially to that kind of submissive foreign policy, it's pretty tough to play very difficult. Now, the one card Europe does have, and we discussed this before, you have, I think it's roughly a $32 to $2 trillion or so delta between the EU and Russia. So you're talking like a 17x economic delta. I mean, it's huge if they use the economic weapon. And I think that's better, and I think it's far less risky than trying to take the military option. So, while I tend to be fairly hawkish when it comes to dealing with sociopaths that you could use those weapons on, I don't necessarily think that it's the right thing to do with Russia by any means. And I do also think that it's kind of difficult for the president to take a tough position because, look, the president made a really good statement when he was there about, you know, we're not going to rewrite the European map at the point of a gun. Well, first off, that's a great statement, Brett. But if that statement is coming from somebody who doesn't respect our nation's own borders, you know, it's basically kind of hot air coming from an empty shell.
Absolutely. Well, John, we have our next guest on the program today. I want to welcome back our good friend, who is the Senior Vice President with the Institute of Energy Research, Dan Kish, who frequents our program, and we've had some wonderful discussions. Dan, it's great to have you back, and we have a long list today, but we'll try our best to get through it.
Well, thanks. Hi, Brett. Hi, John.
So, Dan, just real quick, and I know it's not for a lengthy discussion, but I did come across an article on your website. Of course, you go to instituteforenergyresearch.org to check this out, and it's entitled, Russia Uses Devious Means to Rid the U.S. of Domestic Oil and Gas. And essentially, this is talking about the possibility and the appearance that Russia has been funding environmental groups in the United States who are against fossil fuel production and, of course, most significantly, hydraulic fracturing, things of that nature. So it's interesting story and an interesting thought to really keep in the back of your mind.
It is. It sure is. And I'd leave it up to people to read. And it's actually a mention of a study that was done or a report by the Environmental Policy Alliance that attempts to track down some of this money. This has been something that's been alleged for a very, very long time. I would add, over a number of years, it was always alleged that many OPEC members were assisting through backdoor money to groups opposed to energy development in the U.S. That's not part of this, and that hasn't been mentioned recently, but I know that's been an allegation for many decades, as a matter of fact.
Well, it seems to me, Dan, that a lot of presidential libraries and things of that nature get built by large donations from people who come from the Middle East, so I think that isn't too
You've
hard
noticed.
If we really wanted to. And I'm pointing the finger at not just one particular side of the aisle, by the way, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, I understand. It's a lot of times there were lots and lots of allegations about exactly what. But if you think about it, I mean, this is it's not a lot of money. It doesn't take a huge amount of money in the general scheme of things for people to fund organizations that are that share some of the. They may not be friends or even knowing allies, but the ends are the same. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we saw it with the Verona Papers after the fall of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, John.
You know, Dan, I was just starting to make the point before you came on that we transitioned from the Ukrainian crisis, but you can't remove that from the energy crisis because first off, if it wasn't for fossil fuel based economic power, Russia wouldn't have the capacity to rebuild the military or do any of the pressure, put any of the pressure they are in Europe. But as well, the fact that Europe has spent so much, even with everything that's going on, and to me, again, energy is the clear underpinning that enabled Russia to go into Ukraine in the first place and also virtually guarantees Putin that despite whatever pomp and circumstances might come from Europe, that Europe isn't going to war with Russia because Russia could turn their lights out. And with that all as a backdrop, we still hear both the president and Merkel talking about how the biggest threat to the world is still that big evil thing called we might have too much CO2 being eaten by our trees. So How do you see that having played into this? And do you think at some point these tyrants, including Iran, are going to become a wake-up call to the masses who have to get tired of consuming this nonsense?
Yeah, John. I've always been sort of amazed, and especially amazed with it always seems from my perch, I'll grant, that it's a you know, tends to focus on energy. But I've always been a bit surprised that people don't take more seriously the energy issue when it comes to it's about the only thing that people will go to war for, because essentially it is the essential piece of modern life, and you cannot operate an economy of any size or power without it. It is as absolutely essential as oxygen to economic and sovereign life for nations. And you know, whether certainly we saw it undergird a huge amount of World War II, whether it was the Japanese trying to find supplies of oil throughout the Dutch West Indies, or Hitler turning his coal supplies into liquid fuels so that he could mount his aggression, or you name it. This has been the case for a long, long time, and which always astounds me, because you can lessen the impact that other people have around the world if you simply know that we've got the kind of supplies that we have here in the United States, huge amounts of hydrocarbons of all kind, and then for the president to say we're not going to use these going forward, which is essentially what he's saying with his global warming fetish, is it puts us in a situation where we're basically ignoring one of the largest strengths that we have, which is our tremendous supplies, and to such an extent that he even turns his nose up at Canadian supplies of oil, which are second or third largest proven supplies in the world going forward, because some Hollywood actresses get arrested in front of the White House, and because his he has some people who fund campaigns of friends of his who had a lot of say on that, like Tom Steyer.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. Well, Dan, you alluded to a couple of these topics. Well, John did as well. So I'm going to throw a couple of questions out here for you, and I'll let you answer them in whichever order you prefer. But overall, we've seen, it's roughly about a 60% drop in oil since, I guess, around June. And that has translated to a price at the pump that we're more accustomed to. It's still high, you know, in the course of history, but I'll take it over nearly $4 gas. But so the question there is this good or bad for the economy overall? And then on a secondary question, do you think that we found the bottom or near bottom of this drop? And do you think this is just perhaps a short-term correction, or shall we expect this to start working its way back upward now? And then externally from those questions would be, are there foreign entities that you think are having an impact on the price of oil right now? And is it possible that the prices are being dropped purposely to help deal with, in some manner, as a matter of foreign policy, some of the things that are going on, whether you look at Iran or Russia or Ukraine, or, you know, we could list, go on and on and on and on. But so I'll give you all that, and I'll let you handle it however you'd prefer.
Okay. Well, I think lower prices for energy are always a good thing, and I think Americans are, you know, breathing a sigh of relief that that the recent very high prices that we've seen have been tempered, and they're being able to keep more of that. Now, politicians are going to reach right out and try to grab that. That's another story entirely, so watch that. But I just can't help but think that lower prices for energy helps generally the economy across the board. It hits some particular stocks hard. It hits some regions hard, namely those regions that were enjoying huge benefits in terms of employment and investment and the like when the price was much higher. And therefore, you know, this miracle free economy that we have when it's allowed to operate fills a void, i.e. not enough supply to meet the demand with increased supply, and that means the cost balance, and that's what was happening. So we had all this activity around the country chasing after oil wherever they could get their hands on it, investing in huge amounts. We all heard the stories about employment in North Dakota and the like, and now that's tempered a bit because supply has caught up with demand or here and abroad. And in terms of the international, some members, most notably the Saudis, have decided that they're not going to reduce pumping. Some people allege that it's to try to starve out fracking in the United States, North America, and the rest. Others have alleged that it has more to do with their ongoing dislike of both Russia and Iran, and the fact that because prices are lower, both of those nations are hurt. I don't know what the answer is, but again, if there's one thing that makes the world go round, it's energy, and it's just a damn shame, if you pardon my French, that our own government doesn't recognize that and use that to put it to use as a strategic national asset, and instead seeks to do just the opposite with it. And as far as price going up or down, I think it's still too volatile to figure out exactly where that's going. And we're going to have to see, how the economies around the world are reacting to this. We're still increasing production, even though we're reducing the amount of rigs on a weekly basis because of some, built-in energy that is working its way through the system. So I don't think we've seen we will continue to see an uptick in production through about half of this year, and then I think we'll see a supply response as a result of reduced activity.
But Dan, I'm still laughing inside because I almost emptied my bottle of water through my nose with your global warming fetish comment before. But I have to tell you, I'm glad you spoke to the strategic national asset aspect of this, because when you look at the entirety of the equation, it's very rare, but energy is one of those things that it does drive everything. It's extremely important for foreign policy. It's extremely important for economics, both from a foreign trade as well as either a catalyst or an anchor on economic growth. It absolutely is a national security asset, as you pointed out, with both Germany and Japan in World War II. Both had many advantages that we were able to stifle because we were able to cut off supplies of, look at how many Panzer tanks, which were far superior to our tanks, had to stop simply because they ran out of gas. And it's pretty hard for a dozen infantrymen to pick up a 60,000-pound tank and move it. So when you look at the importance of this, I wanted to move back to the land grab aspects of this, because there is, in my opinion, you look at what the recent decision that the president made regarding Alaska, and while I, like most conservatives that I know, am a big fan of the environment, I also think we have to have a balanced approach, because nothing like being weak and losing the war to understand how devastating the environment would really look. So if you could, give us a sense of what is your opinion on both the message being sent to our enemies, namely Russia and Iran, as well as the net negative potential effect on our national security via energy independence by that decision, and then if you want to throw in commentary on the pipeline as well, how relevant that is in comparison.
Well, my general take about the message that he's sending is that I'll just be blunt about it. I think the president's actions, regardless of his rhetoric about alternative energy sources and the like, I think most people around the world who are serious, and I consider Putin and other people to be fairly serious players, that they think that's a joke. And that that when they read between the lines and see what his predisposition is towards the real stuff that the world runs on and will run on for many, many decades to come, that he is unilaterally disarming the United States. And, you know, we're not a threat. We're going to be a weaker player in this if I have anything to say about it. And I think that's the message, that's the only message they can take from that, which I'm, you know, disturbs me greatly. Let's see, what did I miss there, John? The pipeline, obviously, I think the Wall Street Journal had perhaps the best editorial in the wake of his declaration that he wanted to stop Anwar from any kind of activity from coming into play in terms of Anwar, because and what they correctly put their finger on is this is much bigger than Anwar. Anwar is an essential part of keeping the Trans-Alaska pipeline open. The pipeline's capacity is 2.1 million barrels a day. It's currently running at a 500,000 barrels a day, which means by way of comparison, the underutilized or the unutilized capacity of the Trans-Alaska pipeline, which would be used if we had sufficient access to energy to put into it, is twice the amount of the Keystone XL, roughly. The Keystone's somewhere in the range of 830. You double that, you're in the 1600 range. That's about how much we are not putting through the pipeline that we could if we had access to Anwar and the very sizable offshore. Basically, by saying no to Anwar and by putting his boot on the neck of any possibility of producing oil in the offshore in Alaska, what you're doing is consigning tens of billions of barrels of oil that could be going down that pipeline, and you're also speeding the day when the pipeline itself will shut down. This is probably one of the most important energy links in terms of national security for the United States that we have. 2 million barrels a day is an enormous potential conduit of energy. It's good for our balance of trade. It's good for you name it across the board. But without that pipeline, if the pipeline can't make it to a time when we do discover further supplies on the slope and it has to be taken down, it sequesters all of that oil and, indeed, the huge quantities of natural gas on the North Slope in the ground. And that is consistent with the green left, which is the driving force and the brains behind the president's entire energy approach.
That's pretty unbelievable when you look at that. I'm sorry, I'm like just thinking to myself, all the other policies domestic-wise that this president has enacted, it's almost like he's trying to reenact what has been so painful to all the European economies. And you're absolutely right. I mean, this country never would have developed into the nation it was without the resource of energy, whether it be oil, coal, or whatnot. And again, John and I both peruse the Institute for Energy Research's website so often, and we constantly come across articles talking about, you know, more solar panel companies or whatnot who are going out of business. They're not getting more grants. It's a failed model, bad batteries, or, you know, whatever it is. And again, I just want to make a clarifying statement here, and I correct me if I'm wrong. I don't think any of us would say that we would rule out any form of energy. It's just that you have to do what makes sense, and that means that you don't get rid of cheap, plentiful, good supplies of energy for things that are much more expensive, have many other issues, and are not sustainable. And you know, John alluded to the article of the UK where, yeah, you have all these solar, you know, you have all these wind farms and things like that, but is wind really keeping them going?
Yeah. No, I mean, here's the – listen, I have no – if tomorrow they announce some breakthrough that said that solar and wind – will solve all of our energy, would give us boundless new energy supplies at a cost that comes in lower than existing sources, and that when we scale it up in order to run our country and economic growth, it would be sufficient to do so, I'd jump up and down, I think, just like you guys do. It's not that we have any problem per se with it. It's that once you look at it up close and personal, the only reason they're building these things is because the government is either forcing them to by making utilities buy the electricity from these sources. They wouldn't do this willingly because it doesn't make any economic sense. So the government steps in, puts its thumb on the scale and says, you must buy it. That comes from a lot of state regulations. They just fired up a new huge photovoltaic wind or solar farm out in California in the desert on government land today. Flip the switch, and it works. I mean, we can make electricity by burning human bodies. But is that what we want to do? And is that sustainable? Is that something we want to run our economy on? And the point of all this is that you cannot run an economy that is the size and the breadth with all the potential and take care of Americans' rightful desire to remain number one in the world based on this sorts of alternative energy that we have today. And the fact that the president dedicates so much of his time and effort to it is, in fact, a lie to the American public. And in many cases, because of the things that it does to the grid and because of the things that it does to the economics of electricity and all the rest, it's a sort of a hidden, people like alternative energy. That's not the issue. It isn't that it doesn't work or that it's that you can't, we would not be the United States running on the forms of energy that they seem to only like. And for those sources of energy, which we've been thankfully blessed with, you know, some of the largest prodigious supplies in the world, whether that's coal, where our supplies are larger than the next four countries combined, we take that off the table. We take our oil supplies off Alaska off the table. We take most of our OCS supplies off the table with his new plan. And then they try to regulate, increase the government's take or taxes on all of the other sources. In essence, they're trying to kill these sources. We're no other country in the world would do what we're doing willingly. You know, at least with the Europeans, part of the reason they're doing it is because they don't have apparent supplies of alternative of the sorts of supplies of energy that we have. The United States has no
and
we have no excuse.
That, yeah, and to that statement you just made regarding Europe, they should actually be seeking more nuclear energy and not shutting it down.
Yes.
And we're very short on time, but I just wanted to say this. You know, the Grammys were last night, and I'm sure a lot of these Hollywood, you know, or star-like people who are constantly speaking up against, you know, energy resources, I'm sure as they got on their planes to go to the Grammys from wherever they were, they didn't get on a solar run or wind-powered plane. Okay.
Yeah.
So
that's
you know,
absurdity.
And their homes, by the way, I wonder what they're being run on. But anyway, Dan, thank you as always. Folks, you can go to the InstituteForEnergyResearch.org to find out more about the different things that they're working on. And we'll speak to you again soon. Have a great afternoon, Dan. Dan Kish, Senior Vice President of Policy, Institute of Energy Research. Take care, Dan. And, of course, we are right up to the end of the program. We did a wonderful job of that. Anyway, folks, we'll be back again tomorrow. Don't forget James S. Robbins, who comes every Tuesday. Have a wonderful afternoon, and that is a wrap.
The Final Say Radio Show is an original broadcast of Rappaport Media. To hear more The Final Say podcast, go to www.thefinalsay.com.